Marion, we've got both publications here, but Who's Who is probably the easier to read. Hereditary peers are automatically invited for inclusion. She might not have an entry of her own, but if you're lucky, she'll be mentioned in someone else's. Her father's, perhaps, or her husband's. Don't suppose you know when she died? No. Why? Given that you don't know when she was entered, if at all, it might save you time if you just looked her up in Who Was Who first. Need to know when she died for that, though. Nell shook her head. I couldn't even guess. If you point me in the general direction, I'll just check through the Who's Who. Start this year and work backwards until I find mention of her. Might take a while, and the library's closing soon. I'll be quick. The woman shrugged. Take the stairs to the first floor and you'll find the back files at the inquiry desk. The listings are alphabetical. Finally, in 1934, Nell struck gold. It wasn't Rose Mountrachet, but it was a Mountrachet nonetheless. Linus, the uncle who'd claimed Eliza Makepeace after Georgiana's death. She scanned the entry. Mountrachet, Lord, Linus St. John Henry. Born the 11th of January, 1860. Son of late Lord St. John Luke Mountrachet and late Margaret Elizabeth Mountrachet. Married the 31st of August, 1888, Adeline Langley. One daughter, late Rose Elizabeth Mountrachet. Married late Nathaniel Walker. Rose had married Nathaniel Walker. That meant, didn't it, that he was her father? She read the entry again. The late Rose and Nathaniel. So they'd both died earlier than 1934. Was that why she'd been with Eliza? Had Eliza been appointed her guardian because her parents were both dead? Her father, that is, Hugh, had found her on the Maryborough Wharf in late 1913. If Eliza had been appointed guardian after Rose and Nathaniel were killed, that meant, didn't it, that they must have died before then? Suppose she were to look up Nathaniel Walker in Who's Who for that year. He was sure to have an entry. Better yet, if her theory was correct and he was no longer alive in 1913, she should go straight to Who Was Who. She hurried along the line of shelves and plucked out Who Was Who, 1897 to 1915. Fingers trembling, she flicked through from the back. Z, Y, X, W. There he was. Walker, Nathaniel James, born the 22nd of July, 1883, died the 2nd of September, 1913. Son of Anthony Sebastian Walker and Mary Walker. Married the late Honourable Rose Elizabeth Mountrachet, the 3rd of March, 1908. One daughter, the late Ivory Walker. Nell stopped short. One daughter was correct, but what did they mean by late? She wasn't dead, she was very much alive. Nell was aware suddenly of the library heating, felt she couldn't breathe. She fanned her face and looked back at the entry. What could it possibly mean? Could they have got it wrong? Found her? Nell looked up, the woman from the front desk. Are these ever wrong? She said. Do they ever get things wrong? The woman pursed her lips thoughtfully. Well, they're not the most reliable sources, I suppose. They're put together with information supplied by the subjects themselves. What about when the entry is dead? I'm sorry? In Who Was Who, the entries are all dead. Who supplies the information then? She shrugged. Remaining family, I expect. Most of it, I guess, they just copy from the last questionnaire the entry provided. Add the death dates and Bob's your uncle. She brushed a bit of lint from the top of the shelf. We're closing in 10 minutes. Let me know if there's anything else I can help you with. There had been a mistake, that was all. It must happen often. After all, the person setting the type didn't know the subjects personally. It was possible, wasn't it, that a typesetter's mind might wander for a moment, the word late be inserted by error, a stranger consigned to early death in posterity's silent eyes. It was little more than a typo. She knew she was the child of whom the entry spoke, and she most certainly was not late. All she needed to do was find a biography of Nathaniel Walker, and she could prove the entry was wrong. She had a name now. Her name had once been Ivory Walker. And if it didn't feel familiar, if it didn't slip over her like a well-worn coat, then that was as it was. There was no accounting for memory, which things stuck and which didn't. She remembered suddenly the book she'd bought on her way into the Tate, all about Nathaniel's paintings. It was bound to include a brief biography. She pulled it from her bag and flipped it open. Nathaniel Walker, 1883 to 1913, was born in New York to Polish immigrant parents, Anthony and Maria Walker, originally Walczyk. His father worked on the city wharves, and his mother took in laundry and raised their six children, of whom Nathaniel was the third. Two of his siblings died of various fevers, and Nathaniel was set to follow his father onto the wharves, when a picture he had been sketching on a New York street was noticed by passerby Walter Irving, Jr., heir to the Irving oil fortune, who commissioned Nathaniel to paint his portrait. Under his patron's wing, Nathaniel became a well-known member of New York's burgeoning society. It was at one of Irving's parties in 1907 that Nathaniel met the Honorable Rose Mountrachet, who was visiting New York from Cornwall. They were married the following year at Blackhurst, the Mountrachet estate near Tregenna, Cornwall. Nathaniel's reputation continued to grow after his marriage and relocation to the UK, and the pinnacle of his career was the commission in early 1910 for him to paint what would be King Edward VII's final portrait. Nathaniel and Rose Walker had one daughter, Ivory Walker, born in 1909. His wife and daughter were Nathaniel's frequent subjects, and one of his best-loved portraits is that named Mother and Child. The young couple were tragically killed in 1913 at A's Gill, when their railway train and another collided and caught fire. Ivory Walker died from scarlet fever days after her parents' deaths. It made no sense. Nell knew she was the child to whom this biography referred. Rose and Nathaniel Walker were her parents. She remembered Rose, had done so instantly. The dates fitted. Her birth, even her voyage to Australia, tied in too neatly with Rose's and Nathaniel's deaths to be coincidence. Not to mention the further connection that Rose and Eliza must have been cousins. Nell turned to the index and ran her finger down the list. She stopped at Mother and Child and flicked to the nominated page, heart thumping. A tremor in her lower lip. She might not remember being called Ivory, but there was no longer any doubt. She knew what she had looked like as a little girl. This was her, sitting on her mother's lap, painted by her father. Why, then, did history think her dead? Who had given such misinformation to who was who? Was it a deliberate deception, or had they believed it themselves? Not realizing that she had, instead, been boarded on a ship to Australia by a mysterious writer of fairy tales. You mustn't speak your name. It's a game we're playing. That's what the authoress had said. Nell could hear it now, the silvery voice like a breeze off the ocean surface. It's our secret. You mustn't tell. Nell was 4 years old again, felt the fear, the uncertainty, the excitement. Smelled the river mud, so different from the wide blue sea. Heard the hungry Thames gulls, the sailors calling to one another. A pair of barrels, a dark hiding space, a thread of dust-flecked light. The authoress had taken her. She hadn't been abandoned at all. She'd been kidnapped, and her grandparents didn't know. That's why they hadn't come looking for her, They'd believed her dead. But why had the authoress taken her? And why had she then disappeared, leaving Nell alone on the boat, alone in the world? Her past was like a Russian doll, question inside question inside question. And what she needed to unravel these new mysteries was a person, someone to whom she could speak, who might have known her then, or know someone who had, someone who could shed light on the authoress, and the Maltrichets, and Nathaniel Walker. That someone, she figured, was not going to be found in the dusty vaults of a reference library. She would need to go to the heart of the mystery, to Cornwall, to this village, Tregenna, to the huge dark house, Blackhurst, where once her family had lived, and she, as a little girl, had roamed. Chapter 19. London, 2005. Ruby was late for dinner, but Cassandra didn't mind. The waiter had given her a table by the large glass window, and she was watching harried commuters hoofing their way home. All these people, the stars of lives unfolding quite outside the sphere in which Cassandra's own life took place. They came in waves. There was a bus stop right out front, and across the street the South Kensington Tube station still wore its pretty coat of Art Nouveau tiles. Every so often the traffic current swept a wind-blown cluster of people inside the restaurant doors, where they would slide into seats or stand by the brightly lit deli awaiting white cardboard boxes of gourmet food to carry home for dinner. Cassandra rubbed her thumb along the soft, worn edge of the notebook and ran the sentence through her mind once more, wondering whether it would sit more easily this time. Nell's father was Nathaniel Walker. Nathaniel Walker, painter to the royals, had been Nell's father, Cassandra's great-grandfather. No, the truth still fitted like someone else's glove, just as it had when she'd first uncovered it that afternoon. She'd been sitting on the bench by the Thames, decoding Nell's scrawled account of her visit to the Battersea house in which Eliza Makepeace had been born, the Tate Gallery, where Nathaniel Walker's portraits were on display. The breeze had picked up, skimming the river's surface and racing up the banks, and Cassandra had been about to leave when something drew her eye to the particularly scratchy passage on the facing page, an underlined sentence that read, "Rose Maltrichet was my mother. I recognize her portrait, and I remember her." An arrow, then, and Cassandra's attention leapt ahead to the title of a book, Who Was Who, under which was printed a hasty list of dot points. Rose Maltrichet married Nathaniel Walker, painter, 1908. One daughter, Ivory Walker, born sometime after, 1909? Check scarlet fever. Rose and Nathaniel both killed, 1913, train crash, A's Gill. Same year I disappeared. Link? A piece of loose paper had been folded into the margins of the notebook, a photocopy taken from a book called Great Rail Disasters of the Steam Age. Cassandra pulled it out again now. The paper was thin and the text faded, but it was blessedly unmarked by the mould spots that were busy devouring the rest of the book. The title at the top read, The A's Gill Railway Tragedy. As bistro noise hummed warmly around her, Cassandra scanned once more through the brief but enthusiastic account. In the dark and early hours of the 2nd of September 1913, two Midland Railway trains left Carlisle Station en route for St. Pancras Station. All those aboard unaware that they were being spirited towards a scene of utter devastation. It was a steep line, traversing as it did the peaks and troughs of the rolling northern landscape, and the trains were hopelessly underpowered. Two facts conspired to drive the trains to their destruction that night. Their engines were smaller than was recommended for the line's steep gradients, and each had been supplied with poorly screened coal, full of slack that prevented it from burning efficiently. After departing Carlisle at 1:35 a.m., the first train laboured to reach the Ayersgill summit. The steam pressure began to plummet, and the train ground to a halt. One can imagine the passengers would have been surprised by the train's sudden stoppage so soon after leaving the station, but not unduly alarmed. After all, they were in safe hands. The guard had reassured them that they'd only be sitting still a few minutes, and then they'd be on their way again. Indeed, the guard's certainty that the wait would be short was one of the fatal errors made that night. Conventional railway protocol suggests that if he'd known how long it would actually take for the driver and fireman to clean the grate and rebuild the steam pressure, he'd have laid some detonators or carried a lantern down the line to signal to any oncoming trains. But alas, he did not. And thus the fates of the good folk on board were sealed. For further down the line, the second engine was also straining. It pulled a lighter load, but the small engine and inferior coal were nonetheless sufficient impediments to cause the driver difficulties. A few miles before Malastang, the driver made the fatal decision to leave the cab and inspect the engine in action. Though such practice seems unsafe by today's standards, it was quite a common occurrence those days. Unfortunately, while the driver was absent from the cab, the fireman also encountered problems. The injector was stalling, and the boiler level had begun to fall. When the driver returned to the cab, the task consumed their attention so fully that they both missed the red lantern being waved from the Malastang signal box. By the time they finished and returned their attention to the line, the first stalled train was but a few yards away. There was no way the second train could stop in time. As can be imagined, the damage was extreme, and the tragedy yielded unexpectedly high casualties. Additional to the collision impact, the parcels van's roof slid over the second engine and dissected the first-class sleeping accommodation behind. The gas from the lighting system ignited, and fire swept through the devastated carriages, claiming the lives of those poor unfortunates who stood in its way. Cassandra shivered as images from a dark night in 1913 assailed her. The steep summit ride, the night-draped terrain through the window, the sensation of the train coming to an unexpected standstill. She wondered what Rose and Nathaniel had been doing at the moment of impact, whether they'd been asleep in their carriage or engaged in conversation, whether they'd even been speaking of their daughter, Ivory, waiting for them at home. How odd that she should be so moved by the plight of forebears she'd only just learned she had. How awful it must have been for Nell to finally discover her parents, only to lose them again in such a terrible way. The door of Carluccio's pushed open, bringing with it a burst of cool air laced with exhaust fumes. Cassandra looked up to see Ruby bustling towards her, a thin man with a shiny bald head close behind. "What an afternoon!" Ruby collapsed onto the seat across from Cassandra. "A group of students right at the last. I didn't think I'd ever extricate myself." She indicated the thin, neat man. "This is Gray. He's a lot more fun than he looks." "Ruby, darling, what a charming introduction." He extended a smooth hand across the table. "Graham Westerman. Ruby's told me all about you." Cassandra smiled. It was an interesting proposition, given that Ruby had known her the sum total of 2 waking hours. Still, if anyone was capable of such a miracle, Cassandra suspected it was Ruby. He slid into a seat. "What a stroke of luck inheriting a house. Not to mention a delicious family mystery." Ruby waved at a waiter and proceeded to order breads and olives for them all. At mention of the mystery, Cassandra's lips tingled with her newfound knowledge, the identity of Nell's parents. The secret, though, sat lumpen in her throat. "Ruby tells me you enjoyed her exhibition," said Gray, eyes twinkling. "Of course she did. She's only human," said Ruby, "not to mention an artist herself." Art historian. Cassandra blushed. Dad said you draw brilliantly. You illustrated a kid's book, didn't you? She shook her head. No, I used to draw, but it was just a hobby. Be it more than a hobby, from what I hear. Dad said I used to muck around with a sketch pad when I was younger. Not anymore. Not for years. Hobbies have a tendency to drop by the wayside, Gray said diplomatically. I submit as evidence Ruby's mercifully short-lived infatuation with ballroom dancing. Oh, Gray, just because you've got two left feet. As her table mates fell to debating Ruby's commitment to the finer points of salsa, Cassandra let her thoughts slip backwards to the afternoon many years before when Nell had tossed the sketch pad and pack of 2B pencils onto the table where Cassandra was busy drowning in algebra homework. She'd been living with her grandmother for just over a year, had started high school, and was having as much trouble making friends as she was making equations balance. I don't know how to draw, she'd said, surprised and unsure. Unexpected presence had always made her wary. You'll learn, said Nell. You've got eyes and a hand. Draw what you see. Cassandra sighed patiently. Nell was full of unusual ideas. She was nothing at all like the other kids' mums, and certainly nothing like Leslie, but she meant well, and Cassandra didn't want to hurt her feelings. I think there's more to it than that, Nell. Nonsense! It's just a matter of making sure you see what's really there, not what you think is there. Cassandra raised her eyebrows dubiously. Everything is made up of lines and shapes. It's like a code. You just need to learn to read and interpret it. Nell pointed across the room. That lamp over there. Tell me what you see. A lamp? Well, there's your problem, said Nell. If all you see is a lamp, you've no chance of drawing it. But if you see that it's actually a triangle on top of a rectangle with a skinny tube connecting them, well, you're halfway there, aren't you? Cassandra shrugged, uncertain. Humor me. Have a go. Cassandra sighed again, a small sigh of extravagant tolerance. Never know, you might surprise yourself. And she had. Not that she'd exhibited any great talent that first time. The surprise had been how much she enjoyed it. Time had seemed to disappear when she had the sketch pad on her lap and a pencil in her hand. The waiter arrived and tossed 2 tins of bread onto the table with continental flair, nodded as Ruby placed an order for Prosecco. As he left, Ruby reached for a wedge of focaccia. She winked at Cassandra and indicated the table. Try the olive and balsamic. They're to die for. Cassandra dunked some focaccia into the oil and vinegar. Come, Cassandra, said Gray. Save an old unmarried couple from bickering. Tell us about your afternoon. She picked up a crumb of bread that had fallen onto the table. Yes, anything exciting? Said Ruby. Cassandra heard herself start speaking. I found out who Nell's biological parents were. Ruby squealed. What? How? Who? She bit her lip, arresting its attempt to tremble into a smile of self-conscious pleasure. Their names were Rose and Nathaniel Walker. Oh, my goodness, Ruby laughed. It's the same as my painter, Gray. What are the odds of that? And us just speaking of him today, and he once living on the same estate as... She froze as realization turned her face from pink to white. You do mean my Nathaniel Walker. She swallowed. Your great-grandfather was Nathaniel Walker? Cassandra nodded, couldn't stop herself grinning. Felt vaguely ridiculous. Ruby's mouth dropped open. And you had no idea. Today, when I saw you at the gallery. Cassandra shook her head, still smiling like a fool. She spoke, if only to force the goofy grin from her face. Not until this afternoon when I read it in Nell's notebook.
"I can't believe you didn't say something as soon as we got here tonight."
"With all your talk of salsa, I imagine she didn't have the opportunity," said Gray. "Not to mention, Ruby darling, that some people actually like to keep their private life private."
"Oh, Gray, no one really likes keeping secrets. The only thing that makes a secret fun is knowing that you weren't supposed to tell it."
She shook her head at Cassandra.
"You're related to Nathaniel Walker. Some people have all the bloody luck."
"It feels a little strange. It's very unexpected."
"Too right," said Ruby. "All those people searching through history in the hopes they're related to Winston bloody Churchill, and provenance drops unexpectedly into your lap in the shape of a famous painter."
Cassandra smiled again. Couldn't help it. The waiter reappeared and poured them all a glass of Prosecco.
"To solving mysteries," said Ruby, holding hers aloft. They clinked glasses and all took a sip.
"Pardon my ignorance," said Gray. "My knowledge of art history isn't what it might be. But if Nathaniel Walker had a daughter who went missing, surely there'd have been a huge search."
He held his palms out towards Cassandra. "I'm not doubting your grandmother's research, but how on earth did the daughter of a famous artist go missing and no one knew it?"
Ruby, for once, had no ready answer. She looked to Cassandra.
"From what I can gather, reading Nell's notebook, all the records say Ivory Walker died when she was 4, the same age Nell was when she turned up in Australia."
Ruby rubbed her hands together.
"You think she was kidnapped, and whoever did it made it look like she had died? How completely thrilling. So who was it? Why did they do it? What did Nell find out?"
Cassandra smiled apologetically. "It seems she never managed to solve that part of the mystery. Not for sure."
"What do you mean? How do you know?"
"I read the end of her notebook. Nell didn't find out."
"She must have found something, though. Formed a theory."
Ruby's desperation was palpable.
"Tell me she formed a theory. Left us something to go on."
"There's a name," said Cassandra. "Eliza Makepeace. Nell wound up with a suitcase containing a book of fairy tales that sparked some memories. But if Eliza put Nell on the boat, she didn't make it to Australia herself."
"What happened to her?"
Cassandra shrugged. "There's no official record. It's like she disappeared into thin air right around the time Nell was being spirited to Australia. Whatever Eliza's plans, they must have gone wrong somehow." The waiter topped up their glasses and asked whether they were ready to order their main course.
"I suppose we should," said Ruby. "Could you give us 5 minutes, though?"
She opened her menu with purpose and sighed.
"It's all tremendously exciting. To think, tomorrow you're off to Cornwall to see your secret cottage. How can you bear it?"
"Are you staying in the cottage itself?" said Gray. Cassandra shook her head. "The solicitor who's been holding the key said it's not really habitable. I've made a reservation at a nearby hotel, the Blackhurst Hotel. It's the house where the Mountrachet family used to live. Nell's family."
"Your family?" said Ruby.
"Yes." Cassandra hadn't thought of that. Now her lips were at it again, acting against her wishes to form a trembling smile.
Ruby shivered theatrically. "I'm completely envious. I'd give anything for a mystery like that in my family's past, something exciting to unravel."
"I do feel quite excited. It started to haunt me, I think. I keep seeing that little girl, little Nell, plucked from her family, sitting alone on the wharf. I can't get her out of my head. I'd love to know what really happened, how she wound up on the other side of the world all alone."
Cassandra felt self-conscious suddenly, realized she'd been doing a lot of talking. It's silly, I suppose.
Not at all. I think it's completely understandable.
And something in the sympathetic quality of Ruby's tone made Cassandra's skin cool. She knew what was coming. Her stomach tightened and her mind grasped for words to change the subject. But she wasn't fast enough.
"There can't be much worse than losing a child," came Ruby's kind voice,
her words cracking the thin protective shell of Cassandra's grief, so that Leo's face, his smell, his 2-year-old laugh, slipped free. Somehow she managed to nod, to smile weakly, to hold back the memories as Ruby reached to take her hand.
"After what happened to your little boy, it's no wonder you're so intent on discovering your grandmother's past."
Ruby gave a little squeeze.
"Makes perfect sense to me. You lost a child, and now you hope to find one."
Chapter 20. London, 1900. Eliza knew who they were as soon as she saw them turn the corner into Battersea Church Road. She'd glimpsed them in the streets before. The old one and the young one, dressed to the nines, doing their good works with all the violent certainty as if God himself had come down from on high and bid them do so. Mr. Swindle had been threatening to call the do-gooders ever since Sammy left them, had let no opportunity pass to remind Eliza that if she didn't find a way to earn the coins of two, she'd find herself in the workhouse. And though Eliza did her best to meet the rent and still leave a little spare for the leather pouch, her gift for rat-catching seemed to have deserted her, and week by week she slipped further behind. Downstairs, a knock at the door. Eliza froze. She surveyed the room, cursing the tiny crack in the mortar, the blocked chimney. Being windowless and unobserved was all well and good when one wanted to spy upon the street, but not much use when gripped by an urgent need to escape. The knock came again. A short, sharp rap, urgent, and then a high, trilling voice that pierced the brick wall.
"Parish calling!"
Eliza heard the door opening, the bell atop tinkling.
"I'm Miss Rhoda Sturgeon, and this is my niece, Miss Margaret Sturgeon."
Then Mrs. Swindle.
"Charmed, I'm sure." "My, what a lot of funny old things, and barely space to swing a cat."
Mrs. Swindle again, her tone soured.
"Follow me, the girl's upstairs. And watch yourselves. Breakages must be paid for."
Footsteps coming closer. The squeaky fourth step, then again, and again. Eliza waited, heart beating as fast as one of Mr. Roden's captured rats. She could picture it, flickering away in her chest, like a flame in a light breeze. Then the traitorous door was open, the two do-gooders framed by the jamb. The older one smiled, eyes receding into folds of skin.
"Ladies of the parish calling," she said. "I'm Miss Sturgeon, and this is my niece, Miss Sturgeon."
She bent forward so that Eliza had to inch backwards.
"And you must be little Eliza Makepeace."
Eliza didn't respond. She tugged slightly at Sammy's cap, which she was still wearing. The old lady's gaze lifted to take in the dark and dingy room behind.
"Oh, my,"
she said, and made a clicking sound with her tongue.
"Your plight was not exaggerated."
She raised an open hand and fanned her full chest.
"No, it certainly was not exaggerated."
She brushed past Eliza.
"Is it any wonder ill health flourished here? No window to speak of."
Mrs. Swindle, offended by the scandalous affront to her room, scowled at Eliza. The older Miss Sturgeon turned to the younger, who had not moved from the doorway.
"I advise you affix your handkerchief, Margaret, what with your delicate constitution."
The young woman nodded and plucked a lacy square from her sleeve, folded it in half to form a triangle, then clamped it over her mouth and nose while she ventured a step across the threshold. Filled with the certainty of her own righteousness, the old Miss Sturgeon proceeded undeterred.
"I'm delighted to announce that we've been able to find somewhere for you, Eliza. As soon as we heard of your situation, we immediately set about trying to help. You're a mite too young for service, and, I suspect, of the wrong character, but we've managed to do very well. With God's good grace, we've found you a place at the local workhouse."
Eliza's breath shortened, caught in her throat.
"So, if you'll gather your things..."
Miss Sturgeon's gaze flickered sideways beneath her blunt lashes.
"Such as they are, we'll be on our way."
Eliza didn't move.
"Come now, don't tarry."
"No," said Eliza. Mrs. Swindle landed a slap on the back of Eliza's head, and the older Miss Sturgeon's eyes widened.
"You're a fortunate girl to be given a place, Eliza. I can assure you there are worse things than the workhouse awaiting young girls left to their own devices."
She sniffed knowingly, and her nose went begging skyward.
"Come along now."
"I won't." "Maybe she's dense," the young Miss Sturgeon said through her handkerchief.
"She ain't dense," said Mrs. Swindle, "just wicked."
"The Lord claims all his lambs, even the wicked ones," said old Miss Sturgeon. "Now try to find some more suitable clothing for the girl, Margaret dear, and be careful not to breathe the foulness." Eliza shook her head. She wasn't going to the workhouse, and neither was she changing out of Sammy's clothing. It was part of her now. This was when she needed her father to appear, heroic, at the door, to scoop her up and take her with him, sailing across the seas in search of adventure.
"This'll do,"
said Mrs. Swindle, holding Eliza's tatty pinafore high. "She won't need any more than that where she's going." Eliza thought suddenly of Mother's words, her insistence that a person need rescue themselves, that with a strong enough will, even the weak could wield great power. Suddenly she knew what must be done. Without another thought, she leapt towards the door. The old Miss Sturgeon, with advantageous heft and surprisingly fast reactions, blocked her way. Mrs. Swindle moved to form a second line of defense. Eliza bucked her head, and her face hit fulsome sturgeon flesh. She bit with all her might. Old Miss Sturgeon let out a scream, clutched at her thigh.
"Why, you little wildcat!
Aunt, she'll have given you the rabies."
"I told you she were a menace," said Mrs. Swindle. "Here, forget about the clothes. Let's get her downstairs."
They each took an arm, and the young Miss Sturgeon hovered nearby, offering useless advice as to the presence of stairs and doorways, while Eliza thrashed this way and that.
"Be still, girl!"
"Old Miss Sturgeon."
"Help!" yelled Eliza, almost breaking free. "Someone help me!" "You'll get a walloping,"
Mrs. Swindle hissed as they reached the bottom of the stairs. Then suddenly an unexpected ally.
"A rat! I saw a rat!
There's no rats in my house!"
The young Miss Sturgeon screamed, leapt atop a chair, and sent an assortment of green bottles scuttling.
"Clumsy girl! Breakages must be paid for!
But it was your own fault if you hadn't been harbouring rats."
"I never did. There ain't a rat within a hair's breadth. Auntie, I saw it. A horrid thing, large as a dog, with beady black eyes and long sharp claws."
Her voice tapered off and she slumped against the chair back.
"I've come over all faint. I'm not made for such horrors." There now, Margaret. Courage to the sticking place. Think of Christ's 40 days and 40 nights.
The old Miss Sturgeon proved her own impressive constitution by keeping a tight grip on Eliza's arm while leaning in to bolster her collapsing niece, who was now snivelling.
But its beady little eyes, the horrible twitchy nose, she gasped. Oh, there it is!
All eyes turned in the direction of Margaret's pointing finger. Crouched behind the coal scuttle, a quivering rat. Eliza willed him freedom.
Come here, you little blighter!
Mrs. Swindle seized a cloth rag and started chasing the rodent about the room, swiping in all directions. Margaret was squealing, Miss Sturgeon shushing, Mrs. Swindle cursing, glass shattering, and then, from nowhere, a new voice, loud and low.
Stop immediately!
All sound evaporated as Eliza, Mrs. Swindle, and the two Mrs. Sturgeon turned to see whence the words came. Standing in the open doorway was a man dressed all in black. Behind him, a shiny carriage. Children were gathered around it, touching the wheels and marveling at the glowing lanterns up front. The man allowed his gaze to pass over the tableau before him.
Miss Eliza Makepeace?
Eliza nodded in a jerky fashion, unable to find words. Too dismayed that her point of escape was now blocked, to wonder at the identity of this stranger who knew her name.
Daughter of Georgiana Mountrachet?
He handed a photograph to Eliza. It was Mother, much younger, dressed in the fine clothing of a lady. Eliza's eyes widened. She nodded, confused.
I am Phineas Newton. On behalf of Lord Linus Mountrachet of Blackhurst Manor, I have come to collect you, to bring you home to the family estate.
Eliza's jaw dropped, though not so low as those belonging to the Mrs. Sturgeon. Mrs. Swindle collapsed onto a chair, victim of a sudden bout of apoplexy. Her mouth opened and closed like a mudflat fish as she bleated confusedly,
Lord Mountrachet? Blackhurst Manor. Family estate.
Old Miss Sturgeon straightened.
Mr. Newton, I'm afraid I cannot let you walk in here and take this girl without seeing some sort of order. We at the parish take our responsibilities.
All should be contained herein.
The man presented a piece of paper. My employer has applied for and been granted wardship of this minor. He turned to Eliza, barely flinched at her unusual outfitting.
Come then, miss. There's a storm approaching, and we've a way to go.
It took but a split second for Eliza to decide. Never mind that she had never heard of Linus Mountrachet or Blackhurst Estate. Never mind that she had no idea whether this Mr. Newton spoke the truth. Never mind that Mother had remained resolutely tight-lipped about her family. That a dark shadow had fallen across her face whenever Eliza pressed her for further mention. Anything was better than the workhouse. And in going along with this man's story, escaping the clutches of the Mrs. Sturgeon, waving goodbye to the Swindles and their cold, lonely rooftop room, it seemed to Eliza that she was helping to rescue herself just as surely as if she'd managed to break free and sprint out of the door. She hurried towards Mr. Newton, stood behind his cloaked arm, and sneaked a glance at his face. At such close range, he was not so large as he had seemed when silhouetted in the doorway. He was barrel-shaped and of medium height. His skin was ruddy, and beneath his tall black hat, Eliza could see a small amount of hair that the years were bleaching from brown to silver. While the Mrs. Sturgeon was scrutinizing the wardship order, Mrs. Swindle finally regained her composure. She pushed forward, thrusting a thin, ropey finger in the direction of Mr. Newton's chest, punctuating every third word.
"This is nothing but a trick! And you, sir, are a trickster."
She shook her head.
"I don't know what it is you want with the girl,
though I can imagine well enough. But you won't steal her from me by your wicked tricks.
I assure you, madam, said Mr. Newton, swallowing a lump of rather apparent distaste. There is no trick afoot.
Oh, no?
Her brows leapt and her lips stretched around a salivary smile.
Oh, no?
She turned triumphantly towards the Mrs. Sturgeon.
It's lies, all lies, and he a nasty liar. This girl ain't got no family. She's an orphan, she is. An orphan. And she's mine. Mine to do with as I please.
Her lip took on a victorious curl as she reached a position she thought unassailable.
She were left me when the girl's mother died because there were nowhere else for her to go.
She paused triumphantly.
That's right. The girl's own ma told me herself she had no family to speak of. Not one mention of no family in the 13 years I knowed her. This man's a shyster.
Eliza glanced upwards at Mr. Newton, who emitted a short sigh and raised his eyebrows. Though it surprises me little that Miss Eliza's mother failed to divulge the details of her family's existence, it does not alter the fact that it is so. He nodded at the old Miss Sturgeon. It's all in those papers. He stepped outside and held the carriage door wide. Miss Eliza, he said, indicating that she should climb inside.
I'll call my husband, said Mrs. Swindle.
Eliza hesitated, hands opening and closing. Miss Eliza?
My husband'll set you right.
Whatever the truth about her family, Eliza realized the choice was simple. Carriage or workhouse. She had no further control over her own destiny, not at this point. Her only option was to throw herself upon the mercy of one of the people gathered here. With a deep breath, she took a step towards Mr. Newton. I have nothing packed.
Someone fetch Mr. Swindle!
Mr. Newton smiled grimly. I can think of nothing here that could possibly have a place at Blackhurst Manor. A small crowd of neighbours had gathered now. Mrs. Barker stood to one side, mouth agape, basket of wet laundry nursed across her middle. Little Hattie leaned her snotty cheek against Sarah's dress. If you would be so kind, Miss Eliza. Mr. Newton stood to the side of the door and swept his hand before the open space. With a final glance at the panting Mrs. Swindle and the two Mrs. Sturgeon, Eliza climbed up the small ladder that had folded down to meet the gutter and disappeared into the dark cavity of the carriage. It wasn't until the door was closed behind her that Eliza realized she wasn't alone. Sitting across from her, in the dark fabric folds of the other side, was a man she recognized. A man wearing pince-nez and a neat suit. Her stomach lurched. She knew instantly that this was the bad man that Mother had warned them about, and she knew she had to escape. But as she turned desperately towards the closed door, the bad man hit the wall behind him, and the carriage lurched forward. Part 2. Chapter 21. The Road to Cornwall, 1900. As they hurtled along Battersea Church Road, Eliza studied the carriage door. Perhaps if she turned one of the knobs, pressed one of the grooves, it would spring open and she could tumble to safety. The quality of that safety was dubious. If she survived the fall, she'd then have to find a way to avoid the workhouse. But it was better, surely, than being spirited away by the man who terrified Mother. Heart fluttering like a trapped sparrow within her ribcage, she reached out carefully, closed her fingers around the lever, and... I wouldn't do that if I were you. She looked up sharply. The man was watching her, eyes magnified behind the lenses of his pince-nez. You'll fall beneath the carriage, and the wheels will slice you through.
He smiled thinly, revealing a gold tooth.
And how would I explain that to your uncle?
13 years of hunting only to deliver you in halves. He made a noise then, rapid sucking sounds that Eliza took for laughter only by the upturned corners of his mouth. As quickly as it started, the noise stopped, and the man's mouth rearranged itself along sour lines. He brushed his bushy moustache, which sat like the tails of two small squirrels above his lips.
Mansell is my name.
He leaned back and closed his eyes, folded together his pale, damp-looking hands on the polished top of a dark cane. I work for your uncle, and I sleep very lightly.
The carriage wheels danced metallic down one cobblestone laneway after another. Brick buildings fled by, grey and grey as far as the eye could see, and Eliza sat stiffly, desperate not to wake the sleeping bad man. She tried to match her own breathing to the thuds of the galloping horses, willed her spinning thoughts to straighten, concentrated on the seat's cold leather beneath her. It was all she could do to stop her legs from shaking. She felt transported, like a character who'd been cut from the pages of one story, where rhythm and context were known, and glued rather carelessly into another. When they reached the speckled outskirts of London and emerged finally from the forest of buildings, Eliza was able to see the angry sky. The horses were doing their best to outrun the dark grey clouds, but what chance horses against God's own wrath? The first drops of rain spat spitefully on the carriage roof, and the world outside was soon blanketed in white. It lashed against the windows and dripped through the thin gaps at the top of the carriage doors. They drove on thus for hours, and Eliza sought refuge in her thoughts, until suddenly they rounded a bend in the road, and a trickle of icy water landed on her head. She blinked through waterlogged lashes, looked down at the drenched patch on her shirt, felt a strong urge to cry. Strange that in a day of tumult it should be something so innocuous as a dribble of water that prompted a person to tears. But she wouldn't let herself cry, not here, not with the bad man sitting just across the way. She swallowed the hard lump from her throat. Without seeming to open his eyes, Mr. Mansell plucked a white handkerchief from his breast pocket and held it towards Eliza, motioned for her to take it. She patted her face dry.
"Such a fuss," he said, in a voice so thin his lips were barely parted. "Such a lot of fuss." Eliza thought at first that he referred to her. It seemed unfair, as she had made very little fuss, but she didn't dare say as much.
"So many years devoted," he continued. "So little reward."
His eyes opened, cool and appraising. Her skin tightened.
"To such lengths will a broken man go."
Eliza wondered who the broken man was, waited for Mr. Mansell to make his meaning clear. But he did not speak again, merely took back his handkerchief and held it between two pallid fingers before discarding it on the seat beside him. The carriage jerked suddenly, and Eliza gripped the seat to steady herself. The horses had changed their gait, and the carriage was slowing. Finally, it stopped. Had they arrived? Eliza looked out of the window, but she could see no house, only a vast, sodden field, and beside it a small stone building with a rain-battered sign above the door. "McCleary's Inn, Guildford."
"I have other business," said Mr. Mansell as he disembarked. "Newton will take you further." Rain almost obscured his next command, but as the door slammed shut, Eliza heard him shout, "Deliver the girl to Blackhurst!" A sharp turn, and Eliza was thrown against the hard, cold door. Shocked from sleep, it took her some moments to remember where she was, why she was alone in a darkened carriage being spirited towards an unknown destiny. Patchily, heavily, it all came back to her.
the summons of her mysterious uncle, escape from the clutches of Mrs. Swindle's do-gooders, Mr. Mansell. She wiped condensation from the window and peered outside. Since she'd boarded the carriage, they'd sped through day and night, stopping only occasionally to change the horses, and now it was almost dark again. Evidently she had been asleep for some time. Just how long, she couldn't tell. It was no longer raining, and a smattering of early stars were visible beyond the low cloud. The carriage lights were no match for the thick dusk of the countryside, quivering as the coachman navigated the bumpy road. In the dim, damp light, Eliza saw the shapes of large trees, black branches scribbled along the horizon, and a set of tall iron gates. They entered a tunnel of huge brambles, and the wheels bumped along the ditches, tossing sprays of muddy water against the window. All was dark within the tunnel, the tendrils so dense that none of the dusk light was permitted entry. Eliza held her breath, waiting to be delivered, waiting for her first glimpse of what must surely lie ahead. Blackhurst. She could hear her heart, a sparrow no longer, but a raven with large, powerful wings, beating within her chest. Suddenly, they emerged. A stone building, the biggest Eliza had ever seen, bigger even than the hotels in London where the Toffs came and went. It was shrouded in dark mist, with tall trees and branches laced together behind it. Lamplight flickered yellow in some of the lower windows. Surely this could not be the house. Movement, and her gaze was drawn to a window near the top. A distant face, bleached by candlelight, was watching. Eliza moved closer to the window to get a better look, but when she did, the face was gone. And then the carriage passed the building, metal wheels continuing to clack along the driveway. They went beneath a stone arch, and the carriage jerked to a halt. Eliza sat alert, waiting, watching, wondering whether she was supposed to climb out of the carriage, find her own way inside. Suddenly the door opened, and Mr. Newton, drenched despite his raincoat, held out his hand. "Come then, miss. We're late enough already. No time for dithering." Eliza took the proffered hand and scrambled down the carriage steps. They'd outrun the rain while she was sleeping, but the sky promised it would catch them up. Dark grey clouds drooped towards the earth, heavy with intention, and the air beneath was thick with fog, a different fog from that in London. Colder, less greasy. It smelled like salt and leaves and water. There was a noise, too, which she couldn't place, like a train rushing repeatedly by. Whoosha, whoosha, whoosha. "You're late. The mistress expected the girl at 2:30. A man was standing in the doorway, dressed a little like a toff. He spoke like one, too, and yet Eliza knew that he wasn't. His rigidity gave him away, the vehemence of his superiority. No one born to quality ever needed try so hard. "Couldn't be helped, Mr. Thomas," said Newton. "Wretched weather the whole way. Lucky we made it at all, what with the Tamar rising like it is." Mr. Thomas was unmoved. He snapped closed his pocket watch. "The mistress is greatly displeased. Little doubt she'll request an audience on the morrow." The coachman's voice turned lemon sour. "Yes, Mr. Thomas, little doubt, sir." Mr. Thomas turned to take in Eliza, swallowed a barbed kernel of displeasure. "What is..."